Hi, welcome to Visual Studio Toolbox. I'm your host, Robert Green, and joining me today is Claude Remeillard.
Yes.
Welcome.
Hi.
Claude is a program manager on the release management team in Visual Studio, and we're going to talk about release management today. And it's a topic that gets a lot of play. There have been tech ed talks and build talks and you know, Channel 9 videos about it, but we're going to kind of look at it from the standpoint of someone who's maybe a little brand new to it, right? Mm-hmm. It's an important part of DevOps in terms of being able to do a better job of releasing software more quickly, et cetera. But as a developer, you know, what do I need to know about release management? What role do I, how much of release management is about the dev? How much of it is about the op? How much of it is about us working together? Mm-hmm. So if you could enlighten us on that and kind of tell us what it is and show some demos, I think that'd be really cool.
All right, that's cool. So basically, I'll just start by talking a little bit about how we think about release management, top down. Then I'll explain how the product works, how the RM is currently structured, which pieces we have, and then I'll do a demo and talk about what's new in Update 3.
Perfect.
So basically, when we think about release management, is we think about it in the context of the overall development lifecycle or application lifecycle. And typically, we've been living a lot on the left side, on the developing it.
Yep.
And actually, with Agile and all of this, now we have a faster cadence in dev. And then what typically happens is that we have a different cadence in operations, and we bottleneck somewhere in the middle. Typically, by the time we get out of dev and we have a new version, to actually go and put it in production, are typically very complex processes.
Yeah.
In many apps, we have multiple components, multiple form factors we need to go to. In many cases, it's manual, so it's very error-prone. You have a lot of configurations. We have examples with like thousands of configurations as part of large app deployments. And there's often some chaos in mm-hmm. who does what, when, was it done properly, and making sure everybody's kind of on board at the right time, and so on and so forth.
It's kind of this DevOps is trying to solve this silo problem where I, as the developer, build the app, and it's tested, and it's perfect, and then I give it to you, and it's kind of like sending it off into a black box, and then somewhere between when I handed it off to you and it's perfect, pristine condition,
yeah.
You rolled it out, and now users are complaining, so it's obviously all your fault, right?
Yeah, or
and you as the ops guy, you sitting around waiting, and then this blob comes over the fence from the developer who claims it works, but of course the developers are lying, and then I install it, and it doesn't work, and of course it's all the developer's fault.
Yeah, it's really that wall in the middle.
And then we point fingers and yell at each other, and we all lose.
And that's where the DevOps movement comes from. It's really... It's a difference of cadence, but it's a difference of requirements on both sides. So on the operation side, if you think about it, they're incented in keeping everything up as much as they can. So changes is a vector of potential failure. So actually, least changes possible, the better it is. And then in dev, the more changes, the best.
Right.
More change means more features, more bug fixes, and a better app. And so we have really like two constituency with two completely contrary goal. I want to change that as often as possible. I want to change the least possible.
And the users, of course, want everything they want, and they want it to work.
And they want it now.
Yeah.
So the premise and the logic in there is basically, and that's what RM does, release management, is really to try and automate that flow. So that the idea is to say, well, if I want to release often, I need to have a mechanism in the middle that gives the certainty and the manage the risk from the upside and gives me the velocity that I want from the dev side.
Right.
So it's kind of, and the answer is really to automate it.
Yep.
So that's what RM does. It helps with that flow. So we really do three or four key things. The first one is really to automate deployment on a given stage. And here we have this primary concept in RM, which is to create a release pipeline or a release path where basically, before I go to prod, I'll go to a series of environment, I'll test it there, and then I'll move it to the next environment. So what we do is, really, I want one way to say, I'm deploying, somebody says, yes, deploy to QA, and then everything deploys fully automated. So that's the one thing we do. And to repeat that on different environment. That's where it gets tricky, because You might have different configuration in QA than in dev. You'll have more machines in prod than you have on your dev box. And so how do we move it from one to the other? That's one of the problems that RM solves. The other one is to automate the workflow. So it's for that coordination. So we can set pre-approver, post-approver, or no approver on any one of those stages. You might say, all my tests are fine, go and deploy to the next stage. Then I can do that on my pipeline. Or I can say, well, before I go to the next stage, you know, Bob needs to approve, and then we can go down. So that's the second aspect, is really to be able to have all these approvers. The other one, which is a little less obvious, but it's really this idea of deploying the same way to all the environment. And in my super duper animation, which is the concept we have is to build once and deploy many times.
Right.
So we build the app once and we take the bits, and it's the bits that we're promoting. It's not changing from branch to branch to branch and associating a branch to an environment. The premise we have in RM is, if the bits I'm going to put in prod, I want to test them in all the other environment because I have valuable tests I'm doing there, then it's the same bits that I should take. Mm-hmm. So we always go from the source and bring it to the other one. And in real life, what happens is I'll deploy to dev, I find some bug. I build again, I deploy to dev and find some bug. And then eventually I go to integrated or whatever my pipeline is. So by the time I deploy to prod, I will have deployed my bits 10, 50, 100 times. So the idea is, in a good pipeline, is to say, well, the way I will be deploying prod, I want to bring that as early as possible in the cycle. Mm-hmm. So it's actually a little part of, often the dev thinks, I need to make the ops guy think and work like dev. Well, actually a good part of it is, no, I need to get the dev side to operate like ops does.
Right.
So that by the time I come across the barrier, well, it's things that actually we know is secure from an ops perspective because we tested it in dev all the time.
Right.
So that's one of the key premise. And the last thing we do, and I'll show that in the demo, is everything that happens to a new version of the code, we create a release transaction for it, and we track the release across the stages and everything that happens to it. So deployments, logs, approvals, all of that into that one transaction. Again, that allows us for diagnostic, but also if you need for audit, come back and look at what happened. Or, you know, what's the latest thing that got deployed into this environment? You get all these details. So the way it works, before we go in, there's like a few components to RM. Mm-hmm. So currently RM is a separate server, so I'll just point it here.
Okay.
So when you put RM in place, you install a release management server on which you can connect to with a release management client, which is a WPF client. And we also have a web client for approvers. It's a single purpose. It's a very simple for business approvers. Often, let's say if you develop internally, it might be Betty in accounting who's an approver before it goes forward. So it's a non-technical UI. So the way it works is, let's say somebody comes in and approve to go to the next environment, RM will go and actually download all the pieces to the target servers. That's in my case in QA. I have a website, a couple of services, and a database in the backend. So we will deploy all the components to all the servers in the environment. If everything works, then we'll consider the deployment successful and then start the workflow. If one of them fail, we have a built-in rollback procedure. So we'll go back and say, okay, something went wrong, go figure what happened. And there's two ways up until update 3. So we can actually do deployment by using installing a deployer on the target server. Uh-huh. In update 3, we introduced a new way to do deployment, which is to use desired state configuration, which is using actually a capability that is already on the Windows server to actually perform the deployment. So that makes it very interesting. You no longer need to go and put a deployer on every one of your target servers. Okay. It's already in there, and basically we just leverage it. It's also involves a different way of doing the deployment, and I'll talk about that a little bit. But that's kind of the big changes in update 3. Actually, I'll just go here. So when we do it with the DSC base, when we use without the deployer. So it's basically the capability is already embedded on the target server. So it's the same mechanism, except we don't have the deployer at the end. And that's based on using what we call a desired state configuration technology or approach. It's from the PowerShell team, actually. Mm-hmm. So, and DSC is a different way of thinking about deploying stuff. So in the traditional way and what we've done up to now, we start with this idea that I have an idea of what my environment is. So I have an assumed state of what it is. And then I define these are all the tasks that I need to do so that I can deploy to my target server. Mm-hmm. And then at the other end, I'll get, hopefully, if everything goes well, the desired state. So my server now with this version of my app and this firewall on or off and so on and so forth. When we think about DSC, it works in a completely different way, where we start with the idea of saying, I will send a manifest to the target server that describe how I want the server to be. And I don't need to specify how to get there. I'm just basically have a manifest that says, I make sure I have this version of IIS, I have this version, and so on and so forth. So it's really just a description. So what happened is on the local target server, DSC will actually look and reach the state that we want to have. And it does that with three steps. It basically will get the current state on the server. So let's say I have a line that says, I want this version of IIS. It's going to look, say, am I already at that version? Yes, I do nothing. No, then let me go and actually set it to what I want it to be. And how to set it is done through what we call a DSC resource, and they're written in PowerShell. So the logic is really, if you already have the set, the DSC resource, then doing a deployment is just refreshing the description. You had this old description, now you have the new description, you push it to the server, and it will automatically snap to the desired state you want to have. So those DSC resources actually, they're starting to be written. A lot of them, you can create your own, and you can share them, and the plan is to have them available in public and private galleries, where one team solves a problem, creates a DSC resource, again, based on PowerShell, more or less, and make it available for their team internally or with the community. So, so that's going to be a big push for us to use that. The other thing that's interesting, then, is that these are a file, everything's a file, and we can keep those and we can version those. So it allows us to do things, for example, to say, well, that's the current configuration I have in prod. I want to reuse it as a base to set my environment for a staging environment. I can do that. Or if I want to doing rollbacks, I can always go back to a previous state that was working. So there's a lot of value in that. All right, so what I'll do now is I'll get into the demo. And I'll show a bit boat model. Let me get here. So right now what we're looking at is the WPF client. So that's a client that you use to track releases, but also that you'll use to configure everything. And I'll show the approval client a little later. So again, here the app is really like broken down in a straightforward way. Releases is where I track those release transactions. So every time I have a new version I'm throwing out, I create a release, and the release tab is where I track that. Mm-hmm. Config app is where I'll config my bits. Where do I get them? How do I install them? Paths is where I'll configure, well, which release paths I have, which stage I need to go through, and who are my approvers, and what machines I'm working on, or Azure assets that I'm composing my pipeline with. Inventory is where we add those shareable things, adding tools, adding things that we want to share, and then admin is admin, security, and so on and so forth. So here on the releases, I'm in the traffic overview, where in my example, I have two pipelines. So I'll just go into the first one. It's the more traditional pipeline. And here, so I can see statistically how many releases I have this week if I had any failures. Here, failures also gives us notification. Okay. I can get an email and a link to it. And if I dig on, well, what went through this pipeline and what went through dev, I have these four releases that went. So each of those is, I had a new version of the code, a new build, and this build actually This is where it went. So, for example, we look at the last one, it went all the way to production.
Okay. So
it's a way for me to track all of them. So I'll just open that one transaction, and I was saying earlier that on a transaction, we get all the details, and we'll go and just look at that. All right, so now I'm in the detail of that one transaction. So and typically, I forgot to mention, the way we create a release is we associate the release to the build template. So in most cases, people just run the build. The build creates the release and triggers RM. Or I can go and manually trigger one from here and pick my build. But most customers just triggers them by linking it to a build definition.
Okay.
So the build starts the release, which is kind of nice. If the release breaks, it breaks the build. Everybody knows right away.
So
it really kind of gives that continuous delivery perspective. So here, for example, I have my this specific release, so which was triggered automatically on this time and date. And in the dev stage, this is what happened to it. So I can see the different approvals that I have. And then what happened in QA and what happened in ops. And then if I look at the detail of the actual deployment itself, then I can see what we've done, what was executed on the target server. So we removed the site. Here what we did is we just made a copy of the site in case we had to roll back, and then we just installed the site. If you look at installing the site itself, we also bring the logs from the target server. So basically whatever would have happened at the other end, we bring it back.
Okay.
If you add your own tools and they do their own logging, and you can, when you add a tool, you can specify an additional log here, and then we'll bring them back too. So that, you, again, you get that full picture.
So is this 100% focused on server apps, websites, services, et cetera?
Yeah, it's pretty much everything that can go on a server. So server apps, Azure apps, where we would draw the line is to say, oh, but now I want to deploy so if you want to test, let's say, a Windows component throughout your pipeline, you would do that. But at the end, say, now I need to deploy that to, 4,000 desktops.
Right.
Then that's where you'll cross over and use System Center to do that. And trigger System Center from here, but you use more System Center for
it. But you could use Release Manager to deploy, to send a client app to System Center for being sent out to desktops.
Yeah.
And I imagine that it's not at the moment automatically hooked up to send something to the store.
Right, no. No, we haven't done that. That's coming out of the box. And there's kind of really two level in there. Is one is we have things out of the box you just use, or you can just go add a PowerShell or add an executable on your own to do it.
Okay.
So the moment the target is actionable with an API or command line, you can just add it. So we're going now and adding more of those capabilities. But customers themselves, they just go and add them on their own. So it's interesting. We learn a lot from customers on that point. We see what they're doing, and they come up with very interesting ways.
And the target can be on-prem servers, it can be in Azure?
Yes, so it can be either on target or on Azure.
Third-party hosted websites at the moment or not?
As long as we can have an access to it, we can deploy to it. What we also added in update 3 is the ability, so one of the constraints we have is our target needs to be a Windows server. So if our target is not a Windows server, our DSC or our deployer doesn't work on, let's say, Linux or Unix. So we have a Chef integration we introduce in update 3. So you can, as your action, you would say, instead of installing it ourselves, we go, well, go and trigger Chef to go and deploy on your components that needs to go on Linux boxes. So that's how we solve that problem. So the other thing we get here is, again, and on the transaction, the details of this is where the package location was dropped by team build. This is the build we use, and so on and so forth. So really the specific of the files we have, so we can go back to it. And we have another concept here, which is very important to solve the fact that things are different from one environment to the other. So what we do, I'll just go here on the call center site. For example, here we define a variable for that specific a component that said, well, in dev environment, use this value, and QA, use this value, and prod, use this value. And some of them have like 10s and 20, and it might be IP, user, accounts to use. So the idea is we define it once. So when the bit gets to the target server, we do an XML transform on the config files or on the command lines, and then we use the values for each of these environments.
Okay.
It's very interesting for when something breaks, the first thing you look at, well, it worked in the previous environment, what's different? So it's an easy way to get there, and also to configure them.
And then when you create the release, you're going to point it at the bits, whether they're sitting
right.
on your machine or they're sitting in TFS
right.
or Git, presumably.
Yeah, so actually for us, from a release perspective, the source control is not important. We don't really care
don't
where
care
the code is.
Source, right, it's, you just care where the executables, the
right.
bits are.
So,
right,
so we're linked to build. So that's what we care about, build or if it's a third party. And I'll right. go into the how we configure
okay.
those components, and you'll see how we make that link. So maybe before I leave this section, here I'll just ask, for example, that's another view that we have of all the releases we have. So so those are the releases I have. I could ask for releases only the ones that are currently in flights or the ones that are currently released to their target. Mm-hmm. I could filter by app, and there's security throughout the app. So if I'm a developer, I would only see those for the project I work on that I've been defined, my team has access to. The same thing for managing values on the stages. We can log by stage type who can, for example, ops edits the values for prod, while mm-hmm. dev edits the value for dev. So we have a lot of security features in the app. So I'll go into how we configure the app itself. And I'll go on the one we looked at. I'll start with this one. So we create what we call a release template. It's a one shot where we define every time I want to deploy, I'm just going to use the same template and apply it over and over. And if I want to change something, I can get to the template, change the template, and the next releases now we'll use the mm-hmm. we'll use a new configuration. So the logic here is, when I create my template, I actually come and I associate it to a build definition. So that's where my association
okay.
is.
Right.
And so for us, when build runs, build says, go and run RM. RM says, oh, this build's calling me, so it's this template. And then we use the API back to TFS to go find where the files were dropped. And actually, we put a retention policy on it so that they are kept, because we want to keep it up until we go to prod. So basically, that's really through that build definition link. We also, again, I was talking about security. We can set security on which group can view, edit, and work on
and
it.
And that checkbox is telling me that you can have it automatically happen after
right.
a build or not, in which case you'd manually start.
Then you'd go manually, and basically yeah. I have to go manually. In this case, you know, you just hit the create a new
okay.
release from there or from the main menu. So here for each of the stages then that I've defined, also in my properties, and maybe I left it, I also linked it to my release path, which is important. So I'll show how we define the path, but it allows me to inherit, well, these are the stage I have and which VMs I have or which subscription I have behind each of these stages.
Mm-hmm.
So those actually will appear here in my list. Those are in my example, because I do everything on my VM, it's just one server. But here I would have the list of servers available or tags. We can actually group servers and tags and say my web VMs. And then when we apply, when we do deployment, basically if I want to go and deploy to it, I just drag it and I can go and actually start. So, okay, on this guy, this is what I want to happen.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a tag, we'll do it for every target meeting the tag condition,
right.
who's been tagged for it. And then from there, for example, here, I can go and start dragging the components I have. Here I add my call center. And the component itself, here I only add one values that I need to set. So this is where in the components that I would go and create new components. And actually, I'll just go back and I'll just edit this guy, and it's going to be more efficient. So this is the definition of my site. And this is where in the source I define where it comes from. So here I say, well, it comes from the main template. And actually, I could say in the drop, this part is in that subdirectory. So that the goal is, if I put different components to different targets, I don't want to put the whole app to every target and just install a part of it. So that's a way for me to point just the subset I need. Or I could have a component that comes that builds independently. So that comes from another build definition. So I might have in my main app 7 or 8 components, mm-hmm. and I might have a shared component that another team does. Then I would go here and define it to go get it from this other component, which can come from another TFS, another project, another TFS, another version of TFS. Or it can come from, it's not built by TFS, it's built by something else. Then we'll go on to the drop location specified where the other build system, or where we drop, I don't know, we receive an email with the latest version and of a third-party component, we drop it somewhere. So that's the way to look at it. So think of RMGo, and we pick all the things you need to make your whole app work, and then we deploy everything together.
Like you said earlier, you're just automating stuff that you would do manually.
Yes. So if I have 10 components, usually I have like 10 sections in my you know, manual run book or description of how to do all of this.
So this is not only automating the process so that once you get it right, it runs correctly forever, but you're also now, you're documenting what it takes to install this thing.
Yes, and you have all the details, cool. and then on every one of the release transactions, it's a snapshot for that version. We copy everything to the release itself. So for the deployment, then you pick how you're deploying it. In that case, it's a next copy. And here you notice I have this installation path. This is where I put my argument, my variable. I could have, in this case I didn't need, but we can add additional variable. For example, if I had a config file that I want to manipulate from one environment to the other, then in this case I would say, oh, before you install, I want to add a variable that I want you to look for. And let's say, I don't know, a user. And maybe because it's credential, I might want it to be encrypted. So it's encrypted everywhere, including in the database. And here I would say, and go look at, you know, config dot, or, you know, whatever dot config. And so go scan on what you're installing in star.config, look for underscore user. That's the way we put our variables in there as a token. And then we'll replace it by the values. So that's kind of the mechanism that allows us to, so I won't save it, that allows us to change values from one environment to the other. The other thing we can do also is, again, as I was mentioning, we have an inventory of pre-done things. So for example, for IIS, I could go and say, well, in addition, I want to configure the app pool. So those are pre-done things that comes with the app. So, and here are the values that you can change from one environment to the other. Okay. You supply them in, and then we'll apply it to the group of servers that meet the tag or to that specific server.
Now, you need to know the names. You don't get a drop down of things actually on that server from there, right?
No, you need to know it, and then you put them in.
Right.
So that's, and again, we have a number of them, the same thing for SQL. And so on and so forth. So and you can actually add
for the create SQL, you give it the script, the SQL script.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Which you can get SQL Server to create for you, and then that could include sample data or not, depending
on what you decided.
Just the SQL statement.
Yeah. So in many ways we use and trigger things, but the work is done in all the tools we already have. It's kind of a big orchestrator when you think about it in synchronization. If you look here.
It's the answer to the problem of every time I want to deploy, I got to do all this stuff, and couldn't I just get someone to do it for me?
Right.
And the answer is
exactly.
Nobody's going to come along and do it for you, but we have software that'll do it for
you. Right. And then the way for you to go and deploy it is build it. Yeah. And the build will trigger the release, and it's all fully automated.
Cool.
Here, if I look at the data, for example, here, this create test data is actually a tool that I added myself as an example of a user. So you can go into the inventory. And you just specify, you can extend it with your own PowerShell, with your own executable. Often creating test data for your app, it's something that you'll do specifically, so you just extend it. So what I'll do is I'll just spend a couple of minutes maybe pointing out this idea I mentioned earlier, which I'll often get people excited, is here we can also drag from the control flow a rollback section. And in the rollback, basically what it does is, if this component fails, or any of the component fails, we're going to go run what's in there.
Right.
So we don't have a magic rollback that takes all the cases, but we have this capability that says, well, if this fails, what do you want to do? So in that case, I took a backup. I just reuse my backup. Okay. The same thing with a database. You do a backup or reimage the machine. So there's a lot of solutions. Here, what we do is really, we will apply it. And one of the ones we see often, specifically when we get closer to prod, is this idea of manual intervention, which actually will send an email to let's say, I'll put Annie, that says, go investigate. There's a rollback. So what happens in that case is they'll get the email with a link to the Lite client. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'll just go back to release management. So this is my approval client, which is really for, I get an email with a link, click on the link, I get to the client, and then I see by default we're on the what I have to approve. So I can pick the release itself. Here it tells me I have one component. This is the bill we're looking at. And what we find also is customer often ask who approved before me and who will approve after me. So we answer that here where they can see, you know, who are all the approvers set on that pipeline. And from there, they can approve, they can reject, or they can reassign. Mm-hmm. We can set the workflows to work with groups or individuals. So maybe it goes to QA, then somebody QA says, oh, today, Claude, you're the one who's going to do the test, and they reassign it to Claude. In the case where it's a manual intervention, we just, and I think I might have on my previously approved. So here you get instructions that come with it that says, well, this is what you should be going and doing right now before you approve and go forward. And then, you know, if the rollback situation is, oh, it's fine, I fix it and I want to retry, we have a retry option, or you just kill the release and basically go fix whatever the big problem is and start the pipeline again.
So is abandoned
again.
Is that something you cancel, or is abandoned a certain amount of time has passed?
You need to go abandon it. So we don't have a after a certain time, it's by default abandoned. In waterfall environments, these period could be long for a version to be on.
Right.
We see that less in Agile, but this works well for both contexts. All right, so I think we have a few minutes left.
Yep.
So what I'll do is I'll show how we do configuration for DSC and how it changes it.
Okay.
So this one is kind of the same map, but viewed from a DSC perspective. And the first thing you'll notice is we have the same control flow, and here we have we had set tags. And what you see that's different is that actually my deployment itself, a lot of the work will actually happen with that cloud deploy in that case, which will just go run the PowerShell.
Oh,
so the way you would do it is here you say use this PowerShell, and the PowerShell might be a DSC or a PowerShell per se. And we will then upload the bits to, for example, the example I have here is I'm going to Azure. So I'm uploading my bits to Azure. And once they're up there, then I'm running this DSC with this configuration, which then will have configuration for each of the environment. And that we will apply up there.
Is there the ability to move from the previous example to this? So can I take the previous example and press a button and have it write the PowerShell scripts for
me? So no, we won't have that. That would be nice.
Is that doable?
Well, in the other one, the leaves, I call like what you really do at the detail in the action is often running a PowerShell and executable. So those don't change. So you'll move them over.
Okay.
Your approval flows won't change. So really the difference is how do I trigger this? So that the release template itself is a different way. So we're not planning to have an automation.
Okay.
We will continue supporting both as we have here. So customer already using the previous approach or the more imperative approach. Mm-hmm. They can still have this app using the way and it works, and then maybe new app put to DSC base, and then over time they can go and move them to DSC base.
Okay.
Going forward, we're going to put a lot of more effort on the DSC aspect of it. So that's the direction we're going. All right. So I'll just show quickly the paths, and so I'll take this one. So this is where I predefine where my app needs to go, like what are those stages. I'll define it once, and basically then every time I go on the stage, this is how I'll go. So for example, I define for every stage, and again, I can add and remove stage, and I define a stage type for them. The stage type, again, it's configurable in the admin. They're important because it's a good thing in an organization that dev means dev and prod means prod, and it's the same thing for everybody. But also we can associate when on the stage type some security on saying, for example, a prod stage type only these groups can go and modify it. Mm-hmm. So that's the other aspect. And then we say, well, this stage, when I define it, I say, well, I want to deploy to stage or I approve to go to dev. But behind the scene, this is where we define, well, actually it means this technical or physical environment. And that's here we can define environments and servers. Or Azure subscriptions. And actually we sync automatically with Azure subscription. So you can basically go in the admin and say, this is an Azure subscription I have. So we will go and we will bring all the VMs you have available on Azure and make them available for you to deploy to. So it's an automatic synchronization. Looking forward, this is also where we're combining with lab management in terms of it's all the same lab, same environment so the next version of release and the next version of lab are really converging on these definitions. So here I say, well, this is the environment. Why we made the difference is sometimes prod is the same prod for multiple pipelines. So really we're thinking in terms of there's a logical step and there's a physical step. And right. I might have servers or VMs shared between pipelines. And so the model is very flexible. And then we can set approvers. So pre-deployment, we can put a deployment. So here, for example, automatically I will approve. So I don't need a stop. Nobody needs to go click anywhere. Or I could set a manual.
Okay.
In that case, then I'll send an email and somebody from the web team needs to approve for me to continue forward. When it's the acceptance, the approver can actually set a time and date for the deployment to occur. So I can get the email and say, oh yes, I approve, but for tonight at midnight or for another time and place. Or I can just put it fully automated, deploy automatically, no email. And actually on the stage, these are the typical approvers we have for, you know, the people who run the test or look at the automated test results that say, yes, it's fine. Then when I can have multiple approvers there, and when the latest of them has approved, then we're going to go to the next environment. Okay. Or I could just say I don't need any approval. So if my deployment included automated tests, so my deployment was successful, I'll just go to the next environment.
Okay.
So we could have a fully automated pipeline all the way to prod, or I have steps every have manual approver every step. So we're very flexible on that aspect.
Because you would typically not automatically send it to QA and prod at the same time.
Right. So usually we'll go one after the other, but you might, you know, on a fully automated pipeline, you will have more and more tests.
Yep.
As you go forward and as they all work, then you go to prod and you might have no approver at all.
Sure.
If everything works, then we're good to go.
Yep.
So that's kind of the other aspect I wanted to detail.
You can set it up so that as long as my unit tests work correctly, I build my unit tests run, if those all succeed,
right,
goes to production.
Right. My automated tests work, my deploy tests.
Right.
Yeah.
So, or it could be it needs to go to QA or it goes to QA.
Right, and I need somebody to look at it.
Clone of production,
right,
because we have two different types of tests.
Yeah.
It's all kinds of flexibility.
So we're very open on very flexible for all these cases. The last thing, I didn't have all the data to show it, so I'll just bring it up, that we've added in update 3, which we're very excited about, is on the release transaction itself. And that is in the DSC-based pipeline. We added a new tab, which is the change summary.
Okay.
So what we do is, let's say I arrive into a new stage in dev. Then we go look at the previous build that went to that stage, and we make the diff in terms of the linked work item.
Oh, cool.
And this is what has changed. So all the bugs and user stories you have.
All right.
The same release, if it's later on and now it's in staging, that this list would probably be bigger because now I compare to the last one that went to staging. So it's really, how do I compare to the last one to basically where I'm going?
Yep.
So it's really to help with that understanding.
And then you had mentioned you can keep track of all these things and you can know at any point in time what release went where, what was in
it. Right. Yes,
got a,
exactly.
A record of all of what
happened.
Yeah,
so everything is there.
Okay.
So hopefully that gives us a good sense of what's new, and also kind of the basic of what we can do with
release.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Thanks.
All right, thanks.
So it's pretty powerful. It's people can play around with it. You could use Azure VMs to play around with it. You don't need to set up a whole bunch of servers, or you, of course, could if you have multiple machines.
Yeah, and also we have the in the Brian Keller VM that people can download. Mm-hmm. ARM is fully installed, and there's a base pipeline. Actually, that's the one I was using today with the app. So that's another way to
play with it.
There's
probably a hands-on lab in there on it.
And there are lens, exactly.
Awesome.
So that's a way. And you can always download it and try it and install it.
Excellent.
And take it from there.
Great. We'll we'll put up a bunch of resources where people can go learn more and play around with it. But this was an excellent overview of what this thing is. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks.
All right.
All right. Bye.
See you next time on Visual Studio Toolbox.